Hello, and welcome to the Open Heart Project podcast. The Open Heart Project is a community of nearly 12,000 people all over the world who gather together every day to practice mindfulness and meditation. In our podcast, I try to introduce topics that I think will be of interest to this growing, vibrant, interesting community of independent thinkers. Today, our topic is an overview of the Buddhist path. But before I delve into the topic, which is a topic I love very much, I want to just mention that I practice in a particular lineage. I practiced in the Shambhala Buddhist lineage, which is a Tibetan style. And so my view and my ideas are colored by my lineage, by the practice that I do, by the tradition that I belong to, and so on. So though what I want to tell you is something that are things that have been taught for millennia, if you went to a different tradition, they might present similar topics in a somewhat different way. So I just want you to know that this is very much from my point of view as a practitioner, again, in the particular lineage of Shambhala Buddhism. So that said, it'd be good to start our exploration of the Buddhist path with the question, what is Buddhism? Is it a religion? Is it a philosophy? Is it a science of mind? It has variously been called all these things. So, you know, sure, yes, to all of the above, I would say. But the way it was presented to me was as the middle way. Buddhism is often called the middle way, the middle of what? So there are all sorts of religions, obviously, and all sorts of traditions, and all sorts of ways of thinking of things. And they tend, very broadly speaking, to fall into one of two categories. The first is a category called eternalism, which means if we do things a certain way, and if we pay our dues now, and if we act right, and if we do what we believe in, then at some point we will be rewarded in a different world or in a different sphere with all the things we long for. Love and happiness and peace and ease and reunited with the ones we love and so on. Those kinds of thought, in this way of looking at things, are called schools of eternalism. Again, that if we do things right now, later we will get our reward someplace else, and it will be everlasting. The second school of thought, quite the opposite, could be called nihilism, which is the school of thought that says, actually, nothing has any meaning. There is no heaven, there is no hell, this is it, there is nothing more. Doesn't matter how you act, you know, maybe good things will happen to you, maybe bad things. Seems to be independent of the actions that you perform and the thoughts that you think. And when you die, adios, that's it. There is no actual deeper meaning to what is happening in our lives and within ourselves. Okay, so you got your eternalism, you got your nihilism. And perhaps you're gathering why Buddhism is called the middle way. It is neither eternalistic nor nihilistic. Buddhist thought doesn't say, well, if you act right, you'll get a reward later someplace else. Nor does it say that our world is devoid of meaning. The reason I want to start out by pointing out Buddhism as the middle way is that it informs us that it is true both that there is no place else than this, and that everything has tremendous meaning. Also, it's important to point out that Buddhism is non-theistic, meaning there is no external God to believe in or to take guidance from. That said, there are wisdom energies that are ever-present. Such energies sometimes take form in what is called deities of wisdom, deities of compassion, deities of power, peaceful deities, wrathful deities. There's, especially in the Tibetan tradition, which is where I practice, there are many such forms. But it is always emphasized that no matter how many of these forms you connect with or read about or even pray to, they are at once completely real and utterly inseparable from you. You are no different than that. So there is actually no deity outside yourself, yet the world is filled with divinity. Something to contemplate. In Buddhism, the first figure in Buddhism, wait for it, was the Buddha. The Buddha is not thought of as a deity, as a god, but as an actual human being, a historic figure, a person just like you and me, who through devotion and discipline and commitment woke up, attained liberation, became enlightened. And because we are no different than the Buddha, we are also capable of this. So the Buddha is at once a sort of mythic figure that inspires and encourages, and a real person who offers a very down-to-earth example of how to live. So when the Buddha attained enlightenment more than 2,500 years ago, his first teachings were the Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha attained enlightenment, and according to the stories, he went back to his posse and said, "I did it, I'm enlightened." And they said, "How do you know?" And sometimes you may see statues of the Buddha, one hand in his lap and one hand touching the earth. That's called the earth-touching mudra. And when the Buddha was asked, "How do you know you attained enlightenment?" In this case by disruptive figures, he said, "The earth is my witness." And to his friends, he said, apparently said something like, "Well, how did you do it? How could we do it?" And he said, "Well, here are four things that you need to recognize right away. The first is that life is suffering. That's the first noble truth. The entire Buddhist path is built on this truth. However, it does not mean life is a bummer or life sucks. It means instead something we all already know. It means that everything changes. And there is nothing to hold on to. Everything that you can see and hear and feel right now will eventually dissolve and disappear. Not just, you know, physical items like chairs and houses, they will all be gone someday, and not just the people we love and the people we hate, they too will be gone. Our own bodies will be gone, and this is very painful. It is painful because there is no place to hold on. There is no firm ground. And that is suffering. So, no matter how hard we try to create something that lasts, ultimately it will not last. So, we each have to figure out a way to reconcile with that truth. Many terrible acts actually are committed in defense of that truth. Not defending that truth, but defending against that truth. The second noble truth is that suffering comes from grasping. Meaning suffering isn't, what's the word I'm looking for? Suffering isn't a given. Instead, it arises because we try to hold on. We try to hold on to things that we don't want to change and try to push away things that we don't want. So trying to hold on to what we want and push away what we don't want is what creates suffering. So theoretically then, what would alleviate suffering would be neither to hold on nor to push away, which is another way of saying middle way. The third noble truth is that the way we can reconcile with this is embodied in the third noble truth, this is my opinion, which is that karma is real, meaning every action has a consequence. And the action can be something you actually do physically, but it could also be something you think, something you say, something you feel. All of these things, according to Buddhist thought, each one of them plants a seed that will, it is guaranteed, blossom. If we plant good seeds, good things will blossom. If we plant bad seeds, bad things will blossom. Which immediately begs the question, well, I'm a good person, how come bad things happen to me? I do good things all the time. Why do bad things happen to me? And why do awesome things seem to happen to people that are idiots and jerks? Because I'm sure no one can avoid having asked that question at some point in their life. So, yeah, good question. And when you think that in Buddhist thought, I'm not saying everybody has to think this way, but in Buddhist thought, you are reincarnated time after time after time. And the karma that you're playing out now may have been from seeds that were planted many lifetimes ago. You know, back when you were Queen Elizabeth or something, maybe you did something good or something bad that is just now in this lifetime, in the 21st century, coming to fruition. So in this way, karma begins to make a little more sense when we ponder that the spectrum along which our karma plays out is invisible. We can't see the beginning, where it started, nor can we see the end, where it will end. So just something to think about. But nonetheless, the thing to take away here is that karma is real. Your actions have consequences. P.S. You might find those consequences in your next several lifetimes. And the fourth noble truth is that there is a path. It's called the Eightfold Path. And if you follow these eight steps, you will attain enlightenment just like the Buddha. And I don't know that I can repeat the eight steps from memory, but they are like right view, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, right speech, and so on. There are eight of them. And this is the path, these eight steps. Seems kind of straightforward so far, maybe. But I want to introduce now the notion of the three jhanas. The Buddha, it is said, gave three main cycles of teachings. However, some people say there are only two. And the second and third, as I'm going to describe them, are actually one. That's something for scholars to debate. But it has been said that the first two cycles were given during the Buddha's lifetime, and the third cycle of teachings came after his lifetime, somehow. So these eight, the reason I'm talking about this now is because the Eightfold Path looks different when viewed through the lens of each of these three cycles of teachings, which are inseparable. So even though there are three and one came first and the third came last, the first is not the worst and the third is not the best. They are all the best. And they are all completely just three triangles, three pieces, slices of pie, but they are one pie. One yummy pie, I might add. So the first jhana, the first cycle of teachings, is called the Hinayana, H-I-N-A. Jhana, Y-A-N-A, means vehicle. And most often Hinayana is translated in a way that sounds pejorative as lesser vehicle, but I've heard it described as the foundational vehicle also, and that is much more accurate according to my understanding. And in the Hinayana are the basics. You know, they are what you and I need to get straight, right off the bat, if we're going to be on a spiritual path and realize the meaning of our lives. So these basics are things like, you know what, don't kill anyone. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't sexually abuse or use people. Don't be a drunk or an addict. You know, these basics. If those things are problems, stealing and drinking and so on, then, you know, it's going to be hard to walk the spiritual path because you're going to be fighting those things every day. Kind of goes without saying. So many of the Hinayana teachings are about getting your act together through the gesture of discipline. And discipline here doesn't mean making yourself do things you really don't want to do. It's more like recognizing that the Four Noble Truths are real, not BSing yourself anymore, cutting out what is extraneous from your life in order to focus on what is really important. And what is really important, and I'm saying this like I know what I'm talking about, but I feel pretty confident, what is important is your heart, your relationships, your safety, your creativity, you. You are the most important thing in your life, not meaning that you need to be a narcissist or anything, but you have to respect your life, you have to take care of yourself, you have to honor who who you are and what you have, be it meager or prolific. These are the important things, your inner life. So a Hinayana view might say something like, you know what? Maybe you don't need to binge watch all seasons of Project Runway this weekend. Maybe just one. And, you know, pay attention to some other things as well. So I'm kind of joking, but I'm kind of not. So the Hinayana schools describe the path to enlightenment as something that happens over many, many, many lifetimes, that bit by bit, step by step, you improve, you purify, you understand through this focus on getting your life together, and eventually, poof, you attain enlightenment. So the Hinayana teachings, just to wrap this up, are very much focused on discipline and precision and are very earthy and very completely important. You could not practice anything without the basics and without a general sense of discipline. It doesn't matter if you're trying to be Mozart or the Buddha, you need this earth quality. The second cycle of teachings are called the Mahayana. Maha means greater vehicle. And the Mahayana teachings focus on what we need to know when we get some sense of basic stability in our life, our everyday life. Like, basic stability means we have a house, we have a job, we're not in a war zone, we're not possibly starving yesterday or tomorrow. You know, there's a basic sense of, okay, I have a place to live, I have a job, I have some friends, I have a sense of myself. At that point, what happens to all of us naturally, this seems to be how we're built, is our hearts open to other people in a different way, in a way that is more pure than when we are desperate and struggling, whereupon we see everyone who crosses our field as a potential device in our happiness or destruction. And so we don't really see them as discrete beings. We see them as people that could help us or hurt us. People don't like that so much, I'd like to tell you. But when you have a sense, basic sense of ground, then you can relax and you can develop relationships and your heart can open in a way that is softer and kinder. So the Mahayana teachings are very focused on this softness and this opening. And in the Mahayana teachings, we find the most profound teachings, I would say, on compassion, on what it means to be compassionate on two levels. There's a relative form of compassion and an absolute form of compassion, and they're inseparable. The relative form of compassion is what you and I might think of most commonly as compassion, which is being kind and giving when you can and thinking of others and not placing yourself as the most important person in every situation, but extending yourself and opening to others with the intention of being kind, whether that kindness looks like being nice or being sharp, because it could be either. That's the relative form. The absolute form of compassion is somehow equated with the notion of emptiness. And perhaps if you've read any books about Buddhism, you've heard this idea of emptiness, that all phenomena are empty and devoid of identity, which can sound like really nihilistic and like, what? I'm right here. What do you mean I'm empty of existence? I'm sitting right here. True. But if you try to find actually where you begin and end, it's interesting. You can't. So like, when did you start? Did you start when you were born? Did you start when you were conceived? Did you start when your parents were conceived or their parents? And when are you going to actually be gone? Is it when you die and you're cremated or your body's put in the ground? Well, what about the things that you created? What about children that you may have born who carry something of you forward? And if you're a writer, you've written books. Or if you're a painter, you've painted paintings. Or if you're a person, you've spoken to others. If you have a job, you have created forms. Those things still bear your mark. And just because your physical body isn't here doesn't mean those things are gone. So where do you begin and end? I'm just sort of exaggerating to make the point that there is actually no clean line. Oh, this is when I started. Oh, and this is exactly when I stopped. So in that sense, you can't find a separate identity, a you that is separate from the environment. So emptiness here means empty of separate form. Another way of saying it is interdependent. Everything is interdependent. There's only one thing. There's nothing that is separate from that one thing. That's a very subtle and lofty concept and really worthy of many lifetimes of contemplation. But that is how absolute compassion is defined as emptiness. So in the Mahayana, the path to enlightenment is through realization of compassion in both of its forms. You could say there are many ways to describe the Mahayana path to enlightenment. Traditionally, the practitioner on the Mahayana path is called a bodhisattva. Bodhi means awake, and sattva means heart or being, so an awakened being, an awakened heart. And bodhisattvas vow, are people who have vowed to work on behalf of others, all sentient beings. And once everyone has attained enlightenment, everyone, and I mean everyone, then the bodhisattva says, okay, now I will attain enlightenment too, but until everyone has attained it, I am going to postpone my own liberation in order to help others attain liberation. That's a pretty amazing vow, because there's such a thing called the bodhisattva vow when you vow to do that. So the path to enlightenment in the Mahayana could be said to be the path of the bodhisattva. The third jhana is called the Vajra jhana, Vajra, V-A-J-R-A. Vajra is sometimes translated as indestructible or adamantine, which means diamond-like, the indestructible vehicle. And the Vajrayana are teachings that say every moment is a possible moment of complete liberation. When you have basically got your act together through a sense of discipline, and you have learned how to make genuine relationships by opening your heart to others without agenda, with the intention to be kind and helpful, some kind of magic arises in your life. I'm using that word. I'm making that word up in this context. Everything starts to look like your path. Everything that happens seems to have some connection, some meaning, some import along your particular path. So the Vajrayana teachings are about waking up right now and using everything as that possible means. And the path to enlightenment is right now. It's something that happens in this lifetime, immediately, if not sooner. The Hinayana teachings gave rise, and this is a very broad stroke, so please, if you are a Vipassana student or a Zen student, feel free to argue with me because I know you may look at it differently. The Theravadin tradition is the most ancient tradition in Buddhist practice, and one of the main practices of the Theravadins is a meditation style called Vipassana, which is a practice that is widely done now in the West, which is fantastic. I don't think that the Vipassana teachers of our day, our Jack Kornfields, our Tara Brachs, our Sharon Salzbergs, view themselves as Theravadins. I don't know, I could be wrong. But Vipassana traditionally is associated with the Hinayana. And those schools took root in Southeast Asia and remain predominant in places like Cambodia and Burma and Thailand. The Mahayana teachings took root first primarily in China, where it was called Chan, and then in Japan, where it was called Zen. So these are Mahayana schools. The Vajrayana teachings really took root only in Tibet and Bhutan, where they brewed and percolated and deepened and spread for centuries, because Tibet was a hidden nation. It was very hard to get to, and so it was not penetrated by outside forces for many, many, many millennia, centuries, until the Chinese invasion of 1959, whereupon Tibet was basically decimated and all sorts of horrible things that go on today. And the Vajrayana teachings found a way out of Tibet and are now accessible to us in the West for the first time, really ever. And just a brief note about the Tibetan traditions. There are four main schools of Tibetan Buddhism. I hope this is interesting to you. To me, it's fascinating. And they're very much similar in many ways, and they're a little different in other ways. Some schools really emphasize study. Like, that's the way. You've got to study. Like, learn, contemplate, know the Dharma, and also do some practice. Other schools are more like practice. You have to practice, and then you will realize the true nature of the teachings, and you should also study. But all schools of Tibetan Buddhism say study and practice are very, very important. And they are likened to two wings of a bird, study and practice. And if a bird only has one wing, it will just go in circles. So you need two wings to go forward. The oldest school of Tibetan Buddhism is called Nyingma, N-Y-I-N-G-M-A, the Nyingma school or the ancient school, very much focused on practice and very profound. No words could ever describe how profound. Then there's the Kagyu school, K-A-G-Y-U, also called the ear whispered lineage, because I guess it was handed down like this for a long time, whispered from ear to ear. The main figure in the Nyingma school, I would say, figures are Padmasambhava and Yeshe Tsogyal. Padmasambhava is sometimes called the second Buddha, as an Indian yogi, saint, magician, who was sent to Tibet to bring Buddhism to Tibet and eventually did, and his main consort, Yeshe Tsogyal. Ear whispered lineage, the Kagyu lineage, main teachers are Vajradhara, Tilopa, Naropa, Milarepa, Gampopa, and so on. Really brilliant, astonishing teachers whose lineage lasts to this day, absolutely. And the lineage holder of the Kagyu school is the Karmapa. Maybe you've heard of the Karmapa. There's a young Karmapa now in India who has made maybe one visit to the West so far. He's only like 19 or 20 years old. Hopefully he will be here more. And then there is the Geluk school, G-E-L-U-K. The Gelukpas became the largest school of Tibetan Buddhism and remain the largest today. The head of the Geluk lineage is the Dalai Lama and therefore is considered the king of Tibet. And the Geluks, very much deep, profound practitioners, but also amazing scholars. Brilliant. And then the final school I know the least about, the four schools, called Sakya, S-A-K-Y-A. And I'm not going to be able to say much about the Sakya lineage because I don't know much about it. But those are they. Now coming down to present day, I, as I mentioned in the beginning, practice in the Shambhala Buddhist lineage, which is a Tibetan tradition. The Shambhala teachings were brought west by a Tibetan meditation master named Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Chögyam Trungpa held lineages in both the Nyingma and Kagyu schools. So the Shambhala teachings draw both on Nyingma and Kagyu, as well as on the teachings of the indigenous religion of Tibet, which is called Bun, but it's spelled B-O-N, but it's pronounced Bun. So there's a brief overview of the Dharma and various ways to enter the path. The last thing that I want to say is, in answer to a question that I often get asked, which is, how do you become a Buddhist? Or, you know, not whether you want to or not, sometimes it's a question of interest. And by the way, nobody has to become a Buddhist. And you can practice meditation for your whole life. And you can be a Christian or an atheist, and it's all fine. It's completely fine. But there's a certain point, if you want to go deeper, as in a relationship with a person, you make a commitment. And that deepens things. That's the case with most people who are interested in Buddhism. If you want to go deeper, it helps to make a commitment to the path. And once you make this commitment to the Buddhist path, you are no longer whatever else you were. In other words, you can be a meditator and a Christian or an atheist or a Jew or a Hindu or whatever, but you can't be a Christian and a Buddhist, according to my point of view. It's one or the other. Although you can do the practices till the cows come home, and I hope you will. But once you take refuge, which the formal vow ceremony for becoming a Buddhist is called taking refuge, at that point it was said by Chögyam Trungpa, if you ever have to go to the hospital and you have to fill out a form and one of the questions is, what is your religion? Now you have to put Buddhist, because that's how it is. So what do you take refuge in if there's no God or heaven? You take refuge in what's called the three jewels: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Sangha means community. And these are things that you take refuge in from the difficulties and confusions and stresses of this world. You still have difficulty and confusion and stress, but you have a place of refuge from which to relate to them. I took refuge about 18 years ago, and I will attest to the goodness of it. Taking refuge in the Buddha does not mean taking refuge in an external deity. It means taking refuge. Each of these has sort of a twofold nature. In one sense, taking refuge in the Buddha means taking refuge in the notion that there was a person just like you who attained enlightenment. So you can do it too, which is great. But you also take refuge in the idea of Buddha nature, that you have the capacity to awaken, and in fact are already awake, only we're just confused about it, because we just need to shift in our seats like 1 degree and we'll see it, according to all the teachings. But we take refuge in the truth of Buddha nature, which is this capacity to awaken, and in the Buddha nature of all beings. So not just you and me, everybody has Buddha nature. Taking refuge in the Dharma means taking refuge in the teachings. If you have a question, you go look at the books and you go, oh, what do they say about this? There is a canon of wisdom that is vast, beyond concept. Trust me when I tell you this. Whenever I think that I've understood one little corner of one little teaching, the second I step in that direction, okay, got this one, it gives way. And I see that it is immensely deeper than I had thought. And I actually haven't even begun to understand it. So that can sound kind of frustrating, but actually for me it's very reassuring and very heartening that there is this body of knowledge and wisdom that is profound beyond my imagining. And again, I've been studying it for more than 18 years, so what I'm saying is based on that almost 2 decades. So you take refuge in the teachings given by great teachers, but you also take refuge in the fact that wisdom is real. Wisdom is real. There is such a thing as wisdom, and you possess it, and you can take refuge in that. And then you take refuge in the community. The third jewel is called the Sangha. And so you take refuge in whatever lineage you happen to have taken refuge in. For me, it was Shambhala Buddhist. It doesn't mean that the teacher of the Shambhala lineage or any lineage is now your guru. That's way further down the line. But you have a sense of connection and debt and interest to that community who gave you this place to take refuge. And you can make of that what you like. There's no rules there. But you also take refuge in the notion of the human community. There's a sense of taking your seat in your life in this world. You take refuge in the human family. And there are many ups and downs, obviously, but still you have refuge. So the last thing I want to say is an answer to another question that sometimes people ask, which is, if I become a Buddhist, does that mean I have to have a guru? And the answer is no. You can become a Buddhist and not have a guru. However, I will tell you that if someone said to me, in order to become enlightened, should I have a guru? I would say yes, definitely, because it's a complicated path. We have many blind spots, tremendous opportunity for confusion, an inability to tell the difference between wisdom and folly. And I'm not saying, you know, a guru is going to say, that's wisdom, that's folly. But there is some sense of path that deepens when you have a teacher. You know, that said, finding a real teacher is not easy. And I would, you know, that's a subject for another podcast, perhaps. So thank you so much for listening. I hope this has been interesting. And if you have any questions, please go to my website, susanpiver.com, join the Open Heart Project. We can meditate together and have a discussion on any such questions. Thank you.